From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah is one of those landscapes that changes as you head in one direction or another. So it's no surprise that over the years, filmmakers have used the state to represent other places. And this isn't just dusty Western outposts. We're talking Jerusalem in at least one film. Jesus Christ's Sermon on the Mount was shot in Canyonlands. Utah Red Rock became the Gobi Desert when John Wayne played Genghis Khan. And one Revolutionary War battle was staged near Cedar City. Utah's filled in for Germany, Iraq, Timbuktu, Egypt, and let's not forget alien planets. The film historian James Dark has written a book that profiles the history of movie making in Utah. Today in the program, he's joining us to tell the stories of when Hollywood came to town. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For small rural towns in southern Utah, the movie-making business was the perfect industry. When filmmakers came to town, as they often did in the early part of the last century, they brought not only celebrities, but whole communities of staff and crew. And if you played your cards right, you might get a bit part. The film historian James Dark has written an exhaustive history of movie-making in Utah. In the book, he quotes one Moab rancher about the benefits of the movie business. They don't take anything but pictures, he says, and they don't leave anything except money. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with James Dark, talking about his book and telling some stories of the movies in Utah. James Dark is the curator of the BYU Motion Picture Archives at the L. Tom Perry Special Collections at Brigham Young University, the library there. He also teaches in American Studies at BYU. Professor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess you're a film historian, so maybe it's an obvious question, but what got you started with this book of wanting to sort of, all right, let's start putting it together. Let's find out how many films and how they were made. What got you started, I guess?
Coming to Utah.
Oh, is that right?
From Southern California in the late 60s to go to school. And when I realized I was going to be in Utah a while, I wondered, how do I get to know my new adopted state? Mm-hmm. So I took the love of movies that I got in Southern California and applied it to my new state and let the movies made here be my tour guide. Mm-hmm. And as I got to seeing these movies and visiting the stunning locations, I started talking to individuals who had worked on these films, either as extras in Kanab and Moab and other places, St. George. But also, I went to the movie makers themselves, and I found a story that, to Baudelaireize the title of a movie made in Utah, this was the greatest story never told until now.
Because they were just odds and ends here and there. You wanted to sort of put it all together into a
I knew of the John Ford Westerns, Sherry Yellow Ribbon, Stagecoach, the high-profile Westerns in statuesque Monument Valley. What I didn't know was that by the time I finished this study, I would identify more than 800 feature films, television movies, and series episodes filmed in Utah from 1913 through the end of 2009.
You know, much of your time you've said was sort of sorting out the truth from the legend. There's a lot of myth in these stories, I guess.
Well, I think most of your listeners are going to know that great John Ford film, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Yeah. And that whole issue of myth and truth is faced there. When fact meets legend, print the legend, is what the newspaper editor said. So much legend has been circulating about this movie filmed in Utah, that movie filmed in Utah, or in this canyon or that canyon. It took me more than 30 years to authenticate and to document just what movie went where. Whether it was in Utah or California, or if it was in Utah, which part of Utah and which county claimed it on their property. So this was a very exciting story that is as much about people as it is about places. And that's what drove me for more than 30 years to seek out this fascinating story that in my research, Utah has no peer in the United States as far as the close relationship it had. The towns that were the size of Moab and Kanab, having such a close relationship with the Hollywood Motion Picture Studios, Other than towns in California, I saw no other place in the United States that had this kind of close, long-term connection.
What do you make of that? Why was that? Was it because they were many of these smaller places? I'm gathering most of them were Mormons, right? And did that community aspect play a part of the fact that these became sort of community events?
It was the primary aspect, yeah. Because even in the 1920s, when the first film, Tom Mix's The Deadwood Coach, came to Cedar City to be filmed, Hollywood was getting fed up with the familiar California locations. They were looking for something new. Three enterprising Cedar City brothers, Chauncey, Whit, and Gronway Perry, were the ultimate entrepreneurs. They took pictures of Zion, Bryce, the area around St. George, and they went to California during the winters to show pictures to movie producers. Tom Mix, the biggest Western star of the 1920s, bit and came up with his Wonder Horse Tony, and they made The Deadwood Coach in Cedar City, and that started the rush of Hollywood studios. Now, what kept them here was the helpful work ethic of people in Kanab, Kane County, Cedar City. In depressed southwestern Utah, and there was a severe agricultural depression in the 1920s in Utah that few people know about these days, they were desperate for the kind of money that Hollywood could bring up. They did anything they could, grading roads, getting wranglers to get their horses together, getting wagon stocks, rolling stocks together, to make it possible for movie companies to come in on budget, on schedule. Hollywood didn't forget this, and they came back and back and back. And when the Perry Lodge was established in Kanab in the early 1930s, that became the headquarters for more than 100 feature films.
You tell the story, great story of the Boy Scouts. I can't remember which particular community, may have been St. George, setting up tables and chairs. I mean, so in terms of this was a community event. Everyone pitched in, basically.
Everyone, I think, at one point or another in their lives have enjoyed the magic of the movies. And Utahns loved Clark Gable and Gary Cooper and Rita Hayworth coming to town to make a movie, to make that magic. And the fact that so many dollars could come in with these movie companies and favorable publicity that an office of tourism couldn't pay enough money for was quite a narcotic. And let's face it, they had a lot of fun getting autographs. On those days, you could go to a set. Tourists could go and watch a movie being filmed without being shooed away. That wasn't the era of the closed set that we experience nowadays. Movies being made in Utah became a great tourist attraction. I mean, imagine driving on Highway 89 south of Kanab and looking off to the south and seeing about 150 crosses with what looked like crucified people. Well, that's what people saw in 1963 when George Stevens made the greatest story ever told, the biblical film, down there. And if you were a Kane County resident, you could be hired for $30 a day to be one of the converts that Charlton Heston, as John the Baptist, would baptize in a gradually rising Colorado River. Oh, this is heady stuff to people in Utah, and were the source of many, many stories and families from then on.
You know, it's interesting about that story you tell, the greatest story ever told. The images, if you see that film, you won't see that landscape, much of that landscape anymore. It's all underwater. A good part of it is underwater.
Well, and this is part of the argument I make for the value of movie history in Utah as being legitimate, genuine Hollywood history. Movies like My Friend Flicka, The Greatest Story Ever Told, and a host of others show Utah landscapes in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s that existed that way for generations. But with the great boom in property sales in the 21st century, don't look like that anymore. So to me, preserving Hollywood movies filmed in Utah is preserving a vital part of Utah's topographical, ecological history. Duck Creek, the top of Cedar Mountain, in My Friend Flicka, is a beautiful expanse of wide, clear meadows cut by streams and horse ranches. You go up to Duck Creek now, and you'll find it clogged with vacation homes. You wouldn't have an idea of what it looked like because no one took movies of those back in the 1930s and 40s. So Utah movie history is legitimate Utah history, not only because of that, but because of the millions and millions of dollars that are pumped into the Utah economy every year. One of the things that spurred me on in this history was, why haven't I read this story anywhere else? In Utah history books, I read about tourism, mining, agriculture, settlement, religious history. Did somehow this movie history not happen? Mm. Did it not have an impact? Well, it had a great social and economic impact and a worldwide impact on the image that people around the world have of Utah.
Seen as ephemeral. Not seen as a legitimate industry in some way?
Exactly. You know, the movies come and then they go and then they're on the screen and then they're off the screen. This is just a fleeting history and really isn't part of the Utah story. Well, I'm here to tell you it's a great part of Utah's story. And the memories and the lessons and the experiences and the paid-off mortgages and the educations that were paid for by movie money are legend to the people in these towns.
Let's take a call. Jennifer is with us in Bountiful. Jennifer, welcome.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Yeah, my great-grandfather was Merle Vivian Adams, and he was affectionately known as Cowhide Adams. He was a rancher in his lifetime. He lived from 1899 to 1988, and he lived in Kanab, and he was in over 30 different Hollywood cowboy films. And some of those movies included Buffalo Bill, Smokey, Western Union, and The Big Cat. I'm sitting here looking at a really cool picture of him sitting next to Ward Bond and Harry Fonda from the Drums Along the Mohawk, filmed in 1940. And some of the things he did in those movies were he performed stunts like diving off of galloping horses, being pounced on by a mountain lion, and he even died in two films and appeared as an Indian chief. And so this is a huge part of my family's history. And so I am so excited to buy your book and learn more about my great-grandpa.
Mm. James Dark, I guess you talk to a lot of people for which it's a critical part of their family history, all of these stories about being extras and playing in these movies.
That was one of the exciting things about doing research for this book. It was the people, not just the places, that made such a difference. The friendships they had with Preston Foster and with Joel McRae and with Ward Bond and a host of other people were the things that ring down through the years as great memories with these people. And they speak of them fondly. The work was hard, but they found, contrary to, I guess, received public convention, that these movie people, by and large, were folks just like them who worked hard and enjoyed playing with these people, walking down the streets of Kanab and having an ice cream cone, walking up to Maureen O'Hara and just saying hi and having a good conversation. And I have to say, from the entertainer's point of view, they loved working in Utah because people in Moab and Kanab and St. George and other towns in which they worked treated them like human beings. They could have a civil conversation, and they didn't gush over them as stars. They love this.
Really?
Yes.
So they treated them differently than they might on Sunset Boulevard or something.
Exactly. There wasn't the ooh and the ah, but what do you like to do? What do you do on your days off?
Huh.
James Garner, who appeared in a few films in Kanab, including Walt Disney's One Little Indian, even traveled with the Kanab football team to St. George and was rooting for them
Wow.
in the games on a weekend. This they loved. Frank Sinatra donated a complete set of equipment to the Kanab football team after they made Sergeants 3 with the Rat Pack in the early 1960s. It was more than work. These people forged a bond with the people in these cities. And movie crews and performers couldn't wait to get back to Utah.
Film historian James Dark is with us. His book is called When Hollywood Came to Town, A History of Movie Making in Utah. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the film historian James Dark, who's completed a book that profiles the history of movie making in Utah called When Hollywood Came to Town. Let's go back to the phones. Phil is with us in Roosevelt. Phil, welcome. Phil, you with us?
Ranger at Cedar City in the late 30s, and he marked out the timber that was cut to build the fort for drums along the Mohawk. And I guess I was the alternate for the role of the baby in that film, and another baby got the role.
Now, we missed that. Phil, we missed that first part. Were you talking about your father who did that?
Yes, yeah, my father was the assistant district ranger for the Forest Service.
Got it.
There at Cedar City in the late 30s, and he marked the timber that was cut to build the drums along the Mohawk Fort.
Wow.
I love to hear stories like that because I've spoken with people who are still alive. One of them is named Mary Gay Evans in Parowan, who was one of the little children in the fort and remembers hearing the gunfire on the outside and said, well, it was scary, but I wasn't really afraid because I knew that the people who were attacking me were some of my neighbors who were hired as extras.
Yeah. Phil, glad you called. Thanks very much.
May I mention one other one?
Yeah, of course.
When Dad was a district ranger out at Pine Valley, he had a nice Arabian that he had used earlier. He had to buy his own stock. This horse was from Harmony, Dan, and a horse buyer for the movies had seen Dan earlier, before Dad owned him. And he wanted that horse and came to Pine Valley to buy him. And he had Dad ride Dan around, and he said, you've ruined that horse in the mountain. We can't use him in the movies. So that was kind of an interesting event.
Yeah, yeah. Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
Cheers. And how many times did that happen, do you figure, that where stars tried to buy horses off wranglers?
Many, many times. In fact, Wallace Beery and Clark Gable and Gary Cooper came back to Utah repeatedly, not to make movies, but to go hunting. They loved hunting in southern Utah, and they would buy furniture in the homes of some of these people. In Johnson Canyon, east of Kanab, they would buy horses. They would buy quilts. They were fascinated by the Utah culture.
But somebody turned Tom Mix down, though, for his horse, right? He offered, I think it's a story you tell early in, somebody said they were stubborn or something, didn't want to sell Tom
Yes,
Mix the horse.
Wonderful gentleman, since passed away, since I interviewed him, Rupert Roosh in Springdale. Tom Mix wanted to buy his horse, and Rupert said, I turned him down. I shouldn't have done it, but I turned Tom Mix down.
Let me ask you, when Hollywood first really discovered Red Rock Country, particularly Monument Valley, you talk about how the story about who first saw Monument Valley or first had the idea that this would be an iconic image for a film, it's full of contradictions. Do we even know?
We have a pretty good idea. The first one to bring the movies to Monument Valley was not John Ford, which I think is the popular perception.
Yeah.
Rather, it was the great Western novelist Zane Grey, who traveled to Utah on a number of occasions, including to Rainbow Bridge in the early part of the 20th century. He's one of the first to see it, Caucasians to see it. And he wrote a novel called The Vanishing American, and he insisted to Jesse Lasky, head of Paramount Pictures, that the movie, which was ultimately made in the mid-1920s, be filmed on the locations where he set the story. So he put his money where his mouth was, and he organized an expedition on which Jesse Lasky accompanied him to Monument Valley. Mm. So part of the first part of The Vanishing American, a great silent epic that you can still see, was filmed in Monument Valley. That was the first one. Where all of the stories and the claims come about is how John Ford came to find it for Stagecoach in 1939. John Wayne has a claim on it.
Yeah.
Harry Carey Jr. has a claim on it. And Harry Goulding, who was the resident pioneer in Monument Valley, has a claim. And I deal with the swirling accounts and which one might be the most legitimate in the book. So I think I'll save that for a little secret for those who read the book.
Good, good, good. You know, it's interesting. It would be hard to imagine a John Ford film without that landscape. I mean, you can't even imagine it.
One can almost imagine a license plate with Monument Valley on it, and only John Ford's name fits.
Right.
It's as if he adopted it as he owned it. And for the most part, only his films were made there until Sergio Leone came to make Once Upon a Time in the West and filmed a large portion of the movie there. And even then, the Italian director did it as an homage to the master, John Ford.
Let's go back to the phones. Kim is with us in Mount Pleasant, Utah. Kim, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. Good afternoon, or rather good morning.
Still. Morning. Yeah.
I have two questions. First, can you tell me a little bit about the reference you made to a film made in 1913? And then also, has there been any effort, or is it even possible, to create a depository for these films in Utah so that residents of Utah have better access than, say, Southern California? And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Okay. I don't think he said 1913, was it? Or
I think that's what he said. He may be referring to a citation in the book of the earliest known feature film that I've discovered, shot in Utah, and it was called 100 Years of Mormonism, a 90-minute history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which sadly, like many films of the era, is a lost film. Mm. And that's one of the films that I would still love to find. As to the second question about a repository in Utah for these films and materials related to it, I'm happy to announce that we already have it. As curator of the BYU Motion Picture Archive and the Arts and Communications Archive in the Harold B. Lee Library at BYU, I have been collecting these materials for the past 35 years. So we have 16-millimeter prints of many of these films. We have video copies of the others. And we have probably more than 1,000 still photographs, very rare ones, of movies made in Utah and their locations, as well as copies of snapshots taken by locals as early as the late 1920s. When they would wander onto a set and take their little brownie Kodak cameras and take pictures. We have copies of those.
I wanted to ask you about John Wayne. What was his relationship like with the state? I mean, I like to think he had an affection for it. Did he?
Oh, he did. And of course, the most famous, some would say the most notorious film that he made in the state of Utah was playing the role of Genghis Khan.
The Conqueror.
In The Conqueror, which has not only been a movie that earned the Golden Turkey Award in 1980 for his performance, but also for the real serious impact of radiation from atomic bomb testing in the area. And I deal with that issue in the book. Yeah. Was it a direct cause of the death of so many people who worked on the film? Because of the radiation fallout from the Nevada tests. The other complicating aspect of the production of that film is when they went back to Hollywood to do studio shots, the interiors, which they always make in the studio, they hauled back truckload after truckload of the red earth from the area that they believed was infused with the radiation fallout.
What do you think? Did John Wayne die from cancer as a result of those? And John Ford himself as well? I mean, those questions are still...
Well, a number of people who worked on The Conqueror died from cancer. However, the other complicating factor here is most of them were very heavy smokers and drinkers as well. Which was the determining cause? I don't know that we'll ever know. But because of the investigations later on and the whole downwinder syndrome, you can't erase the impact of fallout.
I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Parowan earlier, which got me thinking about a story you tell in the book of them. Because it's not just these scenic Western landscapes with, you know, stagecoaches or horses. It was the setting for many other kinds of places, China in particular, the rice fields of China in Parowan. There's a great story you tell about the filmmakers trying to recreate this plague of locusts.
One of the great prestige pictures of the 1930s was adapted from Pearl S. Buck's famous novel of China, The Good Earth. MGM put a lot of money into it, a high-profile cast that included Paul Muni and most of Hollywood, made to look Chinese. And one of the crucial events is in the book is this massive invasion of locusts. And here is where one of the big problems in southern Utah was, in a very inventive way, used to their advantage. They simply rounded up all these locusts and then let them loose and then started a big fire. And that's one of the great scenes in The Good Earth.
18,000 pounds of grasshoppers they collected. The townspeople?
It's a lot of grasshoppers. Townspeople and farmers in the fields north of Parowan. Yeah.
Tell the story about the film Brigham Young. This was in 1940. Back to this, I guess, locust theme. They were trying to shoot the Mormon cricket and seagull scene, which we're familiar with in Utah, the idea. But they had this difficulty attracting the birds.
Oh, this is a great story. And it comes from the cameraman who was there and a letter that he wrote. Brigham Young was the largest budgeted film at 20th Century Fox in the late 1930s, even bigger than Grapes of Wrath. Daryl Zanuck, the producer, saw the Mormon story as a big one, considering the persecution of Jews in Germany. And the climactic scene is the rescue by the seagulls of this tremendous locust invasion, cricket invasion, rather. And so they chose to film it, a second unit filmed it at Utah Lake. And they had all the crickets there to shoot and to do close-ups. They could not get the seagulls to come out of the sky. They would bait the fields with meat. And after a while, it just stunk to high heaven. Then someone thought to get John A. Widso, who was a member of the church's Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and the liaison between the church and the studio to come down and, see what he could do. They had spent 3 days trying to get these shots, and that's expensive. So Elder John Widso comes down to Utah Lake, and as the cameraman recounted many years later, he offered a prayer. The seagulls came out of the sky, and in the matter of a few hours, they got the footage they needed. So a miracle reborn, yes, but for the movies.
James Dark is with us. His book is called When Hollywood Came to Town, A History of Movie Making in Utah. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with film historian Jim Dark, who we're talking about his book, When Hollywood Came to Town, A History of Movie Making in Utah. Let's go back to the phones. Anne is joining us from Cedar City. Anne, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you that my mother and father both worked on Drums Along the Mohawk, and I was about 5 years old at the time, and I got to be an extra. And I remember we were running across the field with all of these bombs going off, and I got scared, and so I had to run back to my mom and ruin the scene. and then also Claudette Colbert took a liking to me, and she removed my fingernail polish because she said that they didn't have fingernail polish in those days. So it was a fun memory.
Wow.
Now, is this history or is this history?
Yeah. Isn't that great?
I love this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And interacting with Claudette Colbert, wow.
Yes, Merle Morris was a driver for Granway Perry's transportation company that took the stars from the hotel to location. And he still remembers, when I interviewed him a couple of years ago, dancing with Claudette Colbert. He was a very good dancer. She appreciated that fact. And look how long that memory stuck with him.
Yeah, it's great. You talk about, I'm wondering how they treated the land, these filmmakers, right? You know, now this is some very, you know, pristine and fragile territory, these national parks. Did filmmakers always treat it that way? You tell a story about the film, 1927 film, I think it was, Ramona, where they actually built these structures on this, on, I think it was Zion National Park land?
You would never believe it until you see the photographs in the book that a full-size hacienda was built on the west rim of Zion National Park and down in the Temple of Sinueva area. There is no way they would allow that kind of thing nowadays. But that was a different era. That was in the late 1920s. And very soon after that, the National Park Service ratcheted down on their restrictions. The sad thing about that is we don't have that film to see because, again, like many films during the silent film era, it is a lost film. And only the handful of photographs that survive and, frankly, that I obtained from a local Utahn who took the pictures is the only indication as to where these films were made. So it's a vanishing part of Utah history that I didn't want to see vanished.
I remember when I was young, going with a scout group to Piria Canyon. And that's where they shot. And we had such an affection for this film because we saw these, because the thing was still there. The Outlaw Josie Wales was shot there. A part of it was shot there, I think.
That's correct.
So essentially some of these movies created kind of ghost towns, sort of fake ghost towns in some ways.
Well, they created landmarks all their own.
Yeah.
In Johnson Canyon, east of Kanab, MGM built a Pioneer Village for the 1951 Robert Taylor film, Westward the Women. And movie companies and television productions that came after that added on and added on and added on and redressed it, and it's still there. In Perea, the town set that you were talking about was originally built by producer Howard Koch, who made 10 films in the Kanab area for Sargent's 3. They were maintained after that so that when Clint Eastwood and the Outlaw Josie Wales production company came there, they just redressed that set. Sadly, in 1999, all of those buildings were taken down. The BLM resurrected two of them. They were later burned. So no sign of what I call one of Utah's movie landmarks exists there anymore. But, you know, one of the things I love to do is visit these locations. And when I go to the Perea area, I can imagine the great scene in Buffalo Bill when Joel McRae leads the cavalry against Anthony Quinn and the Cheyenne Indians in one of the greatest movie battles of all time. In fact, that was so beautifully filmed by William Wellman in Perea in Technicolor that it was pulled out of that film entirely and used in two other feature films subsequent to that time.
Mm. Let's take another call. Marianne is joining us in Salt Lake. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring an anecdote. I grew up in Cedar City. My father was born in 1900, and his father had a harness shop there, and there a lot of Indians, and there was a lot of local people went in there, just, you know, it was kind of a gathering place. And my father went on a mission in 1925 and 26, and he went to the movies one time, and he said, there up on the big screen, there were the Indians that he saw that were his good friends.
And that happened very often, Mary. Mm-hmm. The Navajos and the Paiutes would be hired frequently by the movie studios, which did a lot to help their tribes and their settlements and provide them with much-needed money that otherwise they wouldn't have.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a great story connected with Western Union, the 1941 film, filmed in Kanab and directed by Fritz Lang. He thought the local Paiutes were too pudgy.
Wow.
And so he sent for Hollywood Indians. And so what you see—
What did that mean?
Well, you hire white actors who are then spray painted to look like Indians for the film because he thought the Utah Indians didn't look Indian enough.
Marianne, thanks. I'm interested in, I guess, the way—at some point it seems And I guess in some ways it was because Westerns weren't as popular, but like the Utah landscape, especially the Red Rock landscape, transformed in some ways from being this, you know, Western thing to being alien. I mean, surreal, and Planet of the Apes. And there were a number of films where they used those amazing formations of Red Rock to not just say this is Earth, this is someplace else.
That's right. And Utah has been used for so many different states, so many different countries, and so many other planets. One could say, unfavorably, Utah has an identity crisis. And yet, if you look at it the other way, from the position of movie makers, Utah is a godsend because it can be so many things for our purposes. Actually, when the younger generation began to dominate movie audiences in the late 50s and early 60s, that's when the Western genre experienced a quick demise. Yeah. Those were the films of their parents, and they didn't want anything to do with anything that their parents would enjoy. But the Western myth is a sturdy one. Where did it go? Outer space. Star Trek and a host of other productions. The morality tales just had another setting, and Utah was wonderful for that. Films like Galaxy Quest, Space Hunter,
yeah.
Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, one of the few 3D movies in the early 1980s when that format was revived. Moab and Emery County were wonderful places for those kinds of films. And even now, John Carter of Mars, the Edgar Rice Burroughs story, is being filmed in Kane County and in other parts in southern Utah, which is destined to be a really big release in 2012.
So you don't think that that we're just talking about a golden era gone by? You still think that these landscapes in Utah, you know, things have changed. Of course, the industry has changed in a lot of ways, but you think Utah is still going to be a part of movies?
Well, it's interesting. As Westerns went out of fashion and television productions increased, the preponderance of productions in southern Utah suddenly moved up to northern Utah, where virtually no films had been made during the golden era of southern Utah's movie production. That's when you have Touched by an Angel, the popular television series, coming to Utah and filming for almost 10 years straight, utilizing so many northern Utah locations that northern Utah took over after a while. You have two installments in the famous Airport series, Airport 75, which was largely shot at the Salt Lake City International Airport, and then Airport 79, the Concorde. I'll tell you, it was getting pretty thin by then. When the Concorde was supposed to be crashing in a European mountain, well, that was actually Alta.
Let me ask you this. We're pretty much out of time, so I'll put you on the spot. Best film ever made in Utah. What do you think?
Oh, which of your children do you like the most?
Really?
No, I will answer your question.
Okay.
It's the 1946 Western that stars Fred McMurray and Ann Baxter called Smokey, the famous Will James story about a drifter who finds this beautiful seal brown stallion and saves him from destruction. It's the most beautiful film shot in Utah and one which very few people have an opportunity to see.
James Dark. His book is When Hollywood Came to Town, A History of Movie Making in Utah. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez, the show directed by Mike Anderson and produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.